been more than a year since the coronavirus outbreak in the U.S. caused schools and businesses to close and safer-at-home orders to go into place around the country. As those closures went on, many people raised concerns about what it would all mean for mental health and warned of an impending rise in suicides. But according to new research, the number of suicides actually may have gone down last year. The preliminary numbers show just under 45,000 suicides in the U.S. in 2020. Still a lot, but down about 5% from the year before. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has this been a difficult year from a mental health standpoint for you or someone close to you? How have you dealt with mental health challenges, maybe for the first time in your life? Have you found new ways to support friends and family? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. By the way, if you or someone you know is considering suicide, you can call the Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255 or text HOPELINE to the number 741-741. Again, that's 741-741. Greg Rogers is a clinical psychologist and behavioral health manager with UW Health. Greg, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, we have these numbers, preliminary numbers on the suicide rate for last year. Looks like they went down. What is your reaction to seeing those numbers for 2020?
Yeah, it's a little surprising given the other indicators that the pandemic has been very stressful for many and that the mental health of our people is suffering. It's probably important to put this in context. I appreciate you noting that it's still a high number. And in fact, the number of deaths by suicide had been increasing for about 20 years and, you know, up about 35% from the year 2000. So 45,000 deaths brings us back to where we were maybe in 2015 or 16. Still a relatively high level. We're talking about the 10th leading cause of death overall, but the fourth leading cause of death for middle-aged adults and the second leading cause of death for adolescents and young adults. So, you know, I don't think anyone, mental health professionals, researchers, advocacy groups, nobody's celebrating this too much.
Right.
45,000 deaths is still unacceptable.
Right. I don't want to just diminish the good side of this, that we didn't see this, what we had feared, this rising number of suicides, still could do a lot better. And I think we still know, and I think everybody sees that there were serious mental health challenges in 2020 still going on. Can you talk about the kind of things you saw or you were concerned about over the last year when it came to the mental health challenges facing people who maybe came to your clinics?
Sure. Yeah. They're, you know, as important as it is to track suicides, that's just one outcome. And there are a number of other trends that indicate the emotional and behavioral health of the population is suffering. You know, the CDC has been doing online what they call pulse surveys, and they're including questions used to screen people for anxiety and mood disorders. And these quick surveys are clearly showing increasing rates of symptoms during the pandemic. It's roughly on the order of 3 to 4 times more people would screen positive for depression or an anxiety disorder. There appear to be higher rates of alcohol and drug use, and that that same data set that showed a decrease in the number of suicides showed an 11% increase in deaths by unintentional injuries in 2020. And that appears to be driven mainly by drug overdoses. And some unknown number of those were actually suicides, but wouldn't be identified as such on death certificates due to a lack of evidence that they were intentional.
One of the many problems going on over this last year was that common systems of support, whether that be a faith community or a kid going to school and having access to services there or in-person therapy or group meetings or whatever, that was disrupted. That said, did you see creative solutions, Greg, where people found different ways to try to deliver some of those services that people were counting on maybe more than ever?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everybody was scrambling in their own ways, you know, individually or as part of a system to remain connected and to get the support for themselves and for others that was needed. So, you know, in our field, we did a quick and sudden pivot to delivering mental health services first by phone and then by video. And we completely, you know, changed our model of service delivery to adapt to this. And then on, you know, individual levels, people, I think a lot more people were doing walks with friends and spending time outdoors and just looking for ways to stay connected without putting themselves at risk of infection.
We're talking to Greg Rogers, clinical psychologist and behavioral health manager at UW Health, looking at mental health over the year of the pandemic. Fears of a big jump in suicide, at least according to preliminary numbers, didn't come to pass, but still plenty of mental health challenges, big and small, facing lots of people around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest. And if you're a provider of mental health services, how did you try to help your clients, your patients this year? If you've needed help, how did you find it? What worked for you? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Mary is with us in Greendale. Mary, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to call and tell you that I work as a nanny part-time. Right before the pandemic, I was working with a really nice family, and when everything started shutting down, literally within 3 days, I never went back in a year. I just started interviewing some more families, and I just had a work experience with a couple that had a child that is 2 years old now. And I came to the house, and I learned from the parents that in almost a year, nobody came to the house, and nobody took that child out of the house. So what we were trying to do is transition this child into having somebody else watch her, like me. The parents were still in the house. We were trying to, but I have to tell you, I have never seen such trauma on a child's face with such severe separation anxiety. I started to cry. I mean, this child was out of her mind, terrified. And I think that we're probably going to be seeing that more. And I think that we are also underestimating what the effects are on especially young children.
Mary, thanks a lot for that call. I want to throw this to our guest, Greg. Kids, one way or another, are likely to have had a lot less contact with other kids, other grown-ups over this last year at key developmental ages. Mary talking about a two-year-old there. What kind of things can we watch out for kids maybe who have had some version of that situation? What kind of things can we do to get them into the swing of things now?
Yeah, that's a great comment. Thanks, Mary. You know, it's very clear that what's unfamiliar to kids is frightening and scary. So there's a couple of things going on here with kids. One is that they may be faced with situations that that us adults think of as being routine and novel, but really they are encountering them for the first time and haven't had a chance to acclimate or develop mastery. And that also connects with the idea that we all need skills, including kids. We need skills to be able to manage social situations. We need to know how we're supposed to act. And it's helpful if we have some idea of how other people are going to react to what we do. And as we come out of this, particularly for those kids and families who have been more locked down or restricted than others, it's going to be a process of acclimating, of gradually re-entering those situations with support, with some coaching. Just given the opportunity to learn or to relearn how to act and how to manage the emotions that arise in those situations.
Mary, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing that experience with us. Let's go next to Adam in Edgerton. Adam, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. You had indicated that the statistics are showing that the overall numbers have gone down. I'm just curious if your guest has any information on the youth suicide rate, if that has also gone down.
Adam, thanks a lot for that call. And Greg, I don't know if it's been, again, these are overall preliminary numbers. I don't know if it's been broken down that well demographically by age or race or other things, but maybe you've seen something I haven't.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen a breakdown by age. And I would highlight that these are preliminary provisional numbers. These numbers are actually, they normally would come out towards the end of this year, but because of the COVID situation and wanting to get an estimate of the impact of COVID, that the number of deaths attributable to different causes, these numbers were released earlier than they normally are. But that said, one thing, I can't speak specifically to the suicide rates in youth, but we do know that it appears that adolescents and young adults appear to be experiencing more distress during this pandemic than older individuals. So that is a focus of concern.
Right now, we're picking up our talk with Greg Rogers, clinical psychologist with UW Health, about research showing that suicides went down over the last year, according to preliminary numbers for 2020, and what the pandemic has meant for mental health and how treatment is provided, the ways we've scrambled to help people. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you're willing to share how you've been doing over the last year, for better or worse, things you've found that help you in tough times, in this tough year, something that might have helped a loved one, or if you're a provider of mental health care yourself, you could share what you've been seeing and how you've been doing your job. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. So, Greg, a tough year in a lot of ways that's been changing the initial shutdown, safer at home orders, schools closing. Now we're in this weird position where things aren't normal yet, but some things are moving toward normal. What kind of things are you watching for people coming in and dealing with mental health as we have this eagerness to be done with this, but we're not quite there yet?
Yeah, you're right. It is a weird time. It is a strange time. And I think a lot of people are, you know, emerging somewhat tentatively and trying to learn the what the rules are of social engagement at this stage. You know, it's not lost on me that, you know, one of the most common reasons that people seek mental health care is for social anxiety, which, you know, we all experience to some extent, but at more extremes can really limit a person. And, you know, for a lot of folks that suffer with that, I wouldn't say the lockdown was welcome exactly, but it provided some temporary relief from some of the stresses and challenges that they faced. And now coming back, it may be even more difficult because, you know, people are frankly out of practice of socializing. And it's weird out there. There is more awkwardness. Everybody's got to be prepared for things to be a little more awkward than they normally are. And we all kind of need to be patient with each other as we get back into the swing of this.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jessica is with us in Cedar Grove. Jessica, hi.
Hi. I was just calling in regards to the woman who had called before about the two-year-old with the separation anxiety and the whole going back into things. My son is a junior in high school. He's 17, and he had been out of school doing at-home virtual since last March. So it had been over a year, and we finally sent him back this quarter. And he, by day two, wanted to stay home. He was so overwhelmed and stressed. But we called the principal and told them, and they actually worked really well with us, and I'm glad we listened to them. The principal said that they had a few kids that were having issues coming back, it was really overwhelming. My son said, I can't concentrate. There's people all around and they're talking, and it was really overwhelming. It was making him anxious. But they worked with him, and the teachers were great. They kind of separated him out a little so he could do his own thing, and then gradually work back in and say, hey, can you at least give me 3 weeks, try 3 weeks. They made little exceptions for him, worked him back in, and we're in week three now, and he's back in the swing of things. But it definitely took him a while to reacclimate being surrounded by people. But if you listen to the teachers and the principal, because their experiences, all these different kids and having different the kids are having different reactions, they know kind of how to deal with it and how to take the steps, and hopefully are willing to walk with them until they're comfortable in school again.
Well, yay. Jessica, thank you so much for sharing that. I'm glad things worked out over time. Greg, what are your thoughts on hearing that story?
Yeah, well, it's a great story. I appreciate hearing it. You know, it's unrealistic to expect that every kid is going to just simply pick up where they left off and enter that school environment and feel comfortable and know what to do. And it's great that the school was willing to be flexible and kind of negotiate and navigate that. I think it's wonderful that Jessica's son was able to label what he was experiencing as anxiety, because I think a lot of parents are probably hearing a mix of things, you know, including like rational arguments about why they shouldn't go to school because maybe they're not vaccinated yet, or that remote learning is working really well for them. But we have to be attuned that to kids simply being anxious about it and be ready to take things slow, not have the expectations be too high, and support them, you know, and kind of normalize that. Yeah, you may not focus very well for the first couple of days. You may not really track what's going on in your classes so well. You may need breaks. But if we can, you know, approach this slowly and gradually and be patient, we'll get back there soon enough.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. And Greg, so we heard Jessica there talk about how her school, in effect, showed her son some patience, so cut him some slack there as he got back in. You talked about needing to be patient with one another. I wonder if there's a lesson here about how we treat ourselves as we try to get back to normal. Do we need to recognize when we're having these troubles and give ourselves a little more patience, cut ourselves a little more slack along the way?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're all going to be in situation, you know, if you believe in the idea of social skills, you know, what's a skill? A skill is something that you have to practice to keep up, and it's gonna weaken without practice. And that's the situation that a lot of us find ourselves in. And so, yeah, people need to give themselves a chance to get the rust off and get back to acting and functioning as normally as they did before this pandemic hit.
Now, Greg, I think it can be easy for a person to be having some kind of mental health challenge but not recognize it in themselves, especially if it's new to them over this last year. What are some of the signs that people can watch for to say, hey, I need to seek some help, whether that's just, you know, from a peer or a faith leader or a parent or whatever, or professional help? What are some of the red flags we can keep an eye out for in our own lives?
Yeah, that's a really good point, because people, you know, often are reluctant to raise their hand and say that they're struggling and ask for help. And so it's really incumbent on all of us to be watching out for each other and looking for changes in the normal personalities of our loved ones, and to approach them with questions and concern. You know, some of the red flags, I mean, when it comes to suicide, like we were talking about earlier, you know, certainly if someone's expressing hopelessness, talking about wanting to die or feeling like they have no reason to live, those are red flags. And more subtle than that are things like talk of feeling trapped or being a burden on others. you also want to, you know, a lot of people will not say anything to, there will be no red flags apparent in what they say. We just have to be looking for changes in their behavior and in their actions and the way that they're conducting themselves, in the way, you know, how withdrawn they are, that kind of thing. I think it's important to put those, so to speak, warning signs into a bigger picture as best you can, like knowing the person's mental health history, their substance use, the nature of the stress that they're under, if they've had exposure to suicide, that sort of thing. That is an important big picture to take into account.
We'll leave it there, Greg. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's Greg Rogers, clinical psychologist and behavioral health supervisor for UW Health. He talked to us about mental health during the pandemic, and new research showing the number of suicides, preliminary number of suicides for 2020, was down compared to the previous year. If you or someone you know is considering suicide, you can call the Suicide Prevention Lifeline. The number is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. You can also text HOPELINE to the number 741-741.